This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Well-behaved women seldom make history. Is that sentence an observation or is it a dare? The words were written by historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich in 1975 in an article published in American Quarterly in 1976. The article was about women in Puritan New England. In 1996, a young woman came across the sentence in a book of quotations by women. She asked permission to print the words on T-shirts. The shirts were a success. Today, you can find the quote on all manner of things, including buttons and bumper stickers, tote bags, and coffee mugs. Ulrich's sentence-turned-slogan now serves as the title of her latest book, Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. It is a concise survey of women's hidden history from the 15th century to the present. Pulitzer Prize-winning Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, currently 300th anniversary university professor at Harvard, is our guest in this portion of the program. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guests this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Ulrich's book, A Midwife's Tale, the life of Martha Ballard, based on her diary, 1785 to 1812, won the Pulitzer Prize in History, the Bancroft Prize, and several other awards. Currently a Phi Beta Kappa scholar, she has also been the recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. Her new book, Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History, is a Borzoi book published by Knopf. 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Ulrich, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's nice to talk with you again. We talked back in 2001 about the book that you had out at that time, The Age of Homespun.
Yes, quite a shift,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, quite a shift. Well, when you wrote those words back in 1975, well-behaved women seldom make history, what did they mean to you? What was the context?
Well, I think it was just a little bit of a cynical comment, maybe directed at my fellow historians in part, as well as to the Puritan ministers that I was writing about. But I really wanted to give these supposedly well-behaved women a history. It seemed like, celebrated in eulogies, they disappeared. They had become just icons, and it was hard to identify them and give them any kind of sense of being players or participants in the world. And I also felt that at the time, the emerging field of women's history had been very interested in witches, for example, or movers and shakers in the women's suffrage movement, but hadn't paid a lot of attention to the mass of women who had sustained our world from year to year. And I think in that early article and then in my later work, I've just been fascinated with the anonymous women, the unknown women.
Is the interest now in the unknown women, the women who contributed so much to domestic life, is the interest in their stories, in their history, on the rise? I mean, after all, we've now had women's studies programs going back to the 1970s and so on, and there are a number of very talented historians working in the field today.
Well, I think the history or the expansion of women's history has been a true renaissance. I think when the field began, people were looking for, you know, the path breakers who were going to transform women's lives. Now we're looking at everything. Women warriors, you know, flamboyant women, women who participate in the media, women artists, but also trying to understand the lives of women who've done the work of the world. It's a very, very broad field. It would be, in fact, I'm looking right now on my desk at a 44-page, 10-point type, or maybe it's even 9-point type, bibliography in comparative women's history, and I'm just thinking, oh, the poor students who are going to have to take a look at that and get ready for their graduate exams, because the field has exploded.
Yeah. Back to this slogan, well-behaved women seldom make history. Tell us about the responses it's received and the variety of women who have taken to it.
Well, it's just been amazing. It started out as a source of sort of mild amusement, and then it really began to puzzle me, because I actually get fan mail, and it's ongoing. people saying, I'm a named plaintiff in a gender discrimination suit, and your T-shirt has given me the power to do this. And then I will get, one of the funniest was from a student who said, I want to use this quote in my honors thesis, and I need to know the actual source because I don't think my professor will let me footnote a T-shirt. Hmm. Sweet Potato Queens, I've had interesting correspondence with that group from Jackson, Mississippi, who do these crazy things on St. Patrick's Day. They dress up in red wigs and false eyelashes and get on a float for the St. Patrick's Day parade, kind of spoofing the whole notion, of the femme fatale. They're raucous, and they celebrate people like Mae West. I could go on and on. Mm. I had a conversation just this week with a man who told me that he and his sisters had put this sentence on their mother's tombstone because she had loved it so much, and somehow it gave her a lot of reinforcement that even though she didn't do things exactly the way everyone else did, she was making a difference in the world.
Why do these words grab us?
Well, I think because they're so ambiguous. They can be interpreted in a kind of mild way, or they can kind of be a justification for causing trouble or stepping outside the traces in some way. I mean, there's a whole range of way of reading them. And I suppose they also grab us because there's still a residue in our society of, the old notion that, girls need to be quiet and silent and they need to be nicer than other people, that we expect women to somehow be softer and more gentle. And sometimes you can't live up to those ideals. And I suppose there's a little comfort saying, well, I blew it. Maybe that's okay. Maybe to stand up for something I believe in, I have to risk being called, that bad word.
Yeah. Did you have a hand in designing the book's jacket?
I did. The people at Knopf came up with the idea, although they came up with quite a few ideas, and we knocked that around. Did we want a well-behaved woman, a sort of stereotypical well-behaved woman on the cover, or we finally fell back on the T-shirt. It was kind of a hard book to capture in a cover because it's about so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to suggest a particular historical period because that would be misleading.
Yeah, so we've got the T-shirt with the slogan, and it's worn by a woman. The body language I find interesting. Crossed arm with some veins kind of visible, popping out a little bit. And then at the neckline, a delicate chain.
Yes, I actually loved that. Once again, the kind of ambiguity. This appears to be a very strong, resolute person, and yet that very sort of little feminine necklace kind of disappearing behind the black T-shirt. One of my colleagues was very disturbed by this cover because we don't see her face, her head. We just see the body. And she said, you know, we worked so many years to give women voices and faces. And so that bothered her. But on the other hand, if we had differentiated this person more as an identifiable person, that would have, again, taken away the ambiguity and the kind of mystery about what this all means.
Yeah, it would have made it more individual.
Yes, yes.
As well.
Uh-huh.
Well, one of the things that you say early in the book is that, you know, notions of good behavior vary from place to place and they change over time. So how do we see a well-behaved woman today? And this is a question that you ask throughout the book. You know, Marie Curie, she was very good at what she did. That's why we remember her. That's
right.
Why she made history.
Right. And yet, I think I'm commenting on the way she was presented in a little book, a charming little book for young people that sort of says she walked into the boys' club of the science world and basically tore the place apart. So even though she seemed like a very genteel person, they wanted to give her this feistiness, this kind of quality, and they did that metaphorically. So they put her along female pirates and, you know, other Queen Njinga of Angola, who was a very, very fierce warrior, and they lined up all of these women as cool women, wild women. And I think, you know, I think there's a sense here of being caught in a dichotomy. It's the old nursery rhyme. When she was good, she was very, very good. When she was bad, she was horrid. So you're either very, very good, which is to say basically invisible, asking nothing for yourself, or going over the edge on the other side. And there is an old idea, a very, very old idea, that somehow, because of their bodies and their reproductive organs, that women tend to swing to extremes, being, you know, Mary and Eve, you know, being the source of evil, being the source of all good in the world. And so what I really tried to do in the book was focus not on definitions of good behavior per se. That is, this isn't a book that tries to define what has been good behavior, because the circumstances change that definition, but to try to think about what it means to make history. Mm. And so this is a book that's really a celebration of the phenomenon that I mentioned earlier, that there's been a recovery of women in history. That's really been one of the magnificent contributions of the women's movement of the 1970s, its real impact on knowledge. Maybe it'll turn out to be one of the most powerful things that came out of the women's movement, is the creation of archives, the creation of bibliographies, the creation of new knowledge about half the human race.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. We're talking with her about her latest book this afternoon, Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now. A listener on line one. Hi.
Hi. Got a couple of quick things. One of the things that we can do along the lines of what you're talking about is document our own women in our own families, and the large and small things that they have done. And I wanted to recommend a book called A Genealogist's Guide to Discovering Your Female Ancestors. The author is Sharon Carmack, C-A-R-M-A-C-K. Gives people some ideas of how to find hard-to-find women, because often their names changed if they married. I also, a separate topic, like the way that some of us have reclaimed the five-letter epithet, and you turn the letters of this word into meaning being in total control of herself. Often women are put down as being bitches if they are they stand up for themselves, if they speak out. And even all the way back to Eve. I mean, she supposedly ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And how terrible that was. Mm. She was an uppity woman.
That's right.
It wasn't just that she gave the apple to Adam. It was a special, very special apple. And I think she's an interesting role model to start out with.
Well, you know, thanks for that example, because that's something that Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the theorists and founders of the women's rights movement in the 19th century, believed. Toward the end of her life, she really upset even her fellow suffragists by trying to rewrite the Bible. And one of the things she tried to do was challenge that negative valence put on the story of Eve, in somewhat the way that you're suggesting, that is, knowledge is a good thing to bring into the world. So that's a very, very uppity interpretation and delightful, and thank you for sharing that.
Thanks for the call. Next we take a call from a listener in Eureka, line 4. Hi.
I guess the question that crossed my mind when you were beginning this interesting topic is the amount of rejection of new roles, new understandings, as you're talking about, that seem to have been reported in media. And I realize from the outset that it's kind of a hit-and-run approach, and perhaps the mass media, like it has been so supportive of this war, has a vested interest in supporting the status quo. But what would be your opinion in terms of the number of women that have come along, say, since the 70s, that have maybe rejected, quote, feminism, and I realize that's a broad area, but rejected the understandings of women in society, as you have been discussing?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
I guess, would you have an opinion as to, is it terribly widespread, the amount of women that are rejecting feminism?
Oh, I see.
I'm sorry, I should have been more clear. And new understanding, you're right, I wasn't clear,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's helpful. Well, we would think so sometimes, wouldn't we? Because of reporting in the media. But I love the comment that a number of scholars made, someone who's done a very important sort of survey of the feminism of the 1970s, Rosalind Baxendall and Linda Gordon. And they say, okay, so this word feminist has become a pejorative term for some women, and I hear this from my students at Harvard as well. I'm not a feminist, but, and we've probably all heard that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if you ask people about specific things, do you support equal education, equal pay, access to child care, you know, freedom from harassment and violence? Do you support even things like the fact that males can be flight attendants on airlines, or maybe that you can be over 30 and be a flight attendant on airlines, or perhaps serious research into breast cancer prevention. We could go on a big, long list of particular agendas that we can document historically having emerged from women's activism. And then you would say, oh my goodness, there are a lot of things that I care about in my life that really did come about because of women who didn't always behave. That is, they didn't accept the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. I might riff a little bit on this listener's call. He used the words rejection and status quo. And experiencing so often in the stories of the women that you've included in Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History, they experience rejection and they reject the status quo.
Yes, that's right. And it, you know, we can go all the way through history. I write some length about the woman who was conceivably the first major historian of women in the Western world, Christine de Pisan, who wrote in the early 15th century, and she was upset at the negative portrayals of women in the major writers of her time and wanted to do something about it. In order to do that, she had to become a writer herself. We can go to the 19th century when very, very well-behaved women who'd been raising money to support missionaries, who had been very supportive of their churches and their voluntary societies, began to want to exercise their voices in the anti-slavery movement. And people said, no, no. And even in some anti-slavery organizations, when they gathered in London in 1842 for an international convention, women could not participate as delegates. And those kinds of experiences of rejection led them then to push back and to create new ways of acting in the world, new ways of making history.
Hmm. I found Christine de Pizan fascinating. I was unaware of her, frankly, before I picked up your book. And, you know, then we have, she's from the 15th century, then 500 years later, if I've got my math right, it's kind of a shaky thing for me. But we've got Virginia Woolf struggling with, she goes looking for women's history. What were the lives of women like during the Elizabethan period?
Uh-huh.
And she, you know, comes up, you know,
comes up empty,
yeah,
because nobody thought to ask except to say, well, they were beaten and forced to marry in their teens, or a few words. So, you know, that's one of the great puzzles and one of the great problems, I think, as we look at the long-term history of women, is how it will be recovered and then lost, recovered and then lost. And Woolf, herself was almost lost by the time I was in school. She was pretty much, you know, considered a kind of minor writer, a modernist, sort of an elitist. And she, too, had to be recovered. So one of the points that I emphasize in the book is that history is not only created by action, by what people do, but what later generations care about. So, you know, do something very important, but if later generations are indifferent, that does not survive. It requires a kind of conversation between present and past to find a place in history.
I wonder if Woolf, like you, wanted to give women a history, give hidden women a history.
Well, she certainly did, although she did it through fiction,
right?
Through the nuances of common life, the interior lives of otherwise unknown people. And of course, she did this fascinating thing when she couldn't find material in the library. about the women who were contemporaries of William Shakespeare, she said, well, I'll make it up. So she created a sister for William Shakespeare. She called Judith, and created this fascinating fable about the woman who's, you know, runs away from home when her father beats her and tries to force her to marry young. You know, goes off to London, tries to get on the stage. Of course, women are not welcome on the stage. She, seduced by gentleman actors. She becomes pregnant. She kills herself in despair. And that's why we have no female Shakespeares, she says. It's not that women are incapable. It's that their circumstances didn't allow it. Well, the amazing and wonderful thing is, even though no one has found a female Shakespeare, we have discovered many fabulous women writers in the last 30 years, including some that could have been Shakespeare's sisters or daughters, people who wrote or painted in the early modern period and now are recognized as important figures in their own right.
Yeah, there are, I believe, in the Shakespeare's daughters chapter, there's a subheading, Three Talented Women.
Yes.
So you have found women who were writing in Elizabethan times.
Right. And writing interesting things. And now, you know, you can go online to wonderful databases created, one created at Brown University, where you can find long lists of women who had been forgotten, who were inaccessible to Wolfe, as she was looking for this information in the library, and that now are being studied in the universities.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I heard you mentioning age and flight attendants. I just learned of a very amazing thing. My niece, who is 52 years old, within the last year and a half, got a job, first time as a flight attendant, with a regional carrier called SkyWest. So I think things are improving a little bit. But
yes.
For anybody who is aspiring to be a flight attendant and is not in their 20s or 30s, there's still hope.
Yes, absolutely. And I love it when I see older women doing these jobs, because really in the early time of, in the 60s, people really had to fight for that right. And one of the things that delighted me as I began to research the recovery of women's history, excuse me, over the last few decades, was how much of this was done by lay persons, people who just on their own are organizing to collect archives, to document patchwork quilts, for example, in most of the states. And then there are these great stories about women who leave one career and adopt another as a scholar. One of my favorites was discovering that Janine Davis Kimball, who perhaps some of you have heard her or seen her work on public television. She's an archaeologist and art historian who's been looking at ancient women warriors in the Russian steppes. And she was really, I think, 60 years old when she decided to begin this work. She had been trained as a nurse and, you know, went back and did her graduate work University of California in late middle age, and then launched this wonderful new career.
There's still hope.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm calling about a person named, the Grimke sisters that did research about before the Civil War about slavery.
Angelina and Sarah Grimke.
Right. And I thought that woman that wrote it was so good, too, because she started her career very late, too.
Gerda Lerner.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Wonderful story, which I share some in the book. There's a wonderful autobiography called Fireweed by historian Gerda Lerner, who really was one of the pioneers in the recovery of women's history.
Well, yeah, she was really good. I'm always trying to get people to read this book. And, you know, I don't know why people shy away from it. I mean, it's just women that I suggest it to, but... I guess there is, you know, still some prejudice even by women themselves about women.
There might be.
Yeah. Anyhow, I appreciate the program. Thank you.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. She is the author most recently of Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, with a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, talk with us a little bit. Tell us about this remarkable woman, Christine de Pizan.
Well, she was born in Italy, and as a child came with her father to the French court of Charles V, and her father was a scribe and an intellectual who was attached to the court. She married very young. She had a couple of children and was widowed. Both her father and her husband died. And so she says in this little autobiographical fragment in one of her many, many works that she had to become a man. I mean, that's the way she described it, in order to carry on, be able to support her family and take care of her mother. And what she meant was she had to take up a work that had been her father's work and her husband's work. And that was the work of a scribe and an intellectual. And she eventually went on and wrote many, many volumes. This is before printing, so these are all handwritten manuscripts, handwritten, hand-copied, and often illuminated with wonderful small watercolors. So one of the books that she wrote was called The Book of the City of Ladies, which is just filled with still very readable, very accessible stories about women in all times and places that she knew about. One of her themes is the ancient kingdom of the Amazons. And she put together little fragmentary stories that were told about these Amazon queens and postulated that there had been a continuous kingdom of women that had lasted 800 years, longer than any other kingdom. And she was making a political point there because there was an argument going on over the succession in the French monarchy, and a kind of specious rule had been made that women could not succeed, eventually ended up in a bitter war over the succession. Christine herself was sort of took refuge in a convent outside Paris. And then an amazing thing happened. A young woman, an actual real-life Amazon, in Christine's view, began to lead France's army. And we know her, of course, as Joan of Arc. And Christine wrote one of the earliest poems in celebration of Joan of Arc, who emerged just about the time that Christine ended her own work and died.
Yeah. We've got a couple of callers I want to get to pretty quickly here, but before we do that, I do want you to tell us a little bit, but can you describe how Christine de Pizan tells the tale of Joan of Arc? That was her last work. You know, Joan of Arc, as you point out, has been seen as, you know, from well-behaved to badly behaved.
To a witch?
Yeah.
Yeah, to the, yes, and of course the English, who were allied with the Burgundians in this fight, the faction that Christine did not support, you know, and even in Shakespeare's play, she's portrayed as bewitched and a really unpleasant person. But Christine, in her poem, said, "The year of 1429, the sun came out to shine again. It was though spring had come back to France," and she said Joan was greater than any of the heroines that we could know about, not only the female heroines of the Bible, like Esther and Judith and Deborah, but also like Moses or Joshua. She just felt like life had come back to France and to her as well. And we think that Christine probably died before the situation turned. Joan was captured and burned at the stake in 1431.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi there. You had mentioned a couple of points earlier that kind of made a natural dovetail for me, talking about kind of the revision of history and women in religion. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear your thoughts on something that was, I can't say popularized, but by the Da Vinci Code, basically the feminization of the Christian Bible. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I really haven't written about that, and I'm not an expert on that, but I will say that what I do know is that the book, the Da Vinci Code, the novel, really picked up and kind of popularized it in some sense, somewhat distorted. I mean, this is what fiction does. Very, very important scholarship on early Christianity in work like the historian Elaine Pagels, her book, The Gnostic Gospels, which shows that there were some ideas, there were some non-canonical texts in the period that did talk about Mary Magdalene, for example, in the some of the ways that have been popularized in the Da Vinci Code. So this is an example of very sophisticated, complex scholarship sort of going pop, I would say. And the scholarship is there, and people can find it and read about it and sort of evaluate it for themselves.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question about Pope Joan. I've heard that there really was a Pope Joan, a woman who entered the clergy, disguised herself as a man, and rose to the ranks of Pope. But I've also heard that that's just a myth, a legend. There's no actual evidence that Pope Joan ever existed.
Well, I wish I had a definitive answer, because somebody else asked me that, and I should have looked it up. It's not something I've researched. I think it is a myth. I'm pretty positive of that. The question of women dressing up and impersonating men, though, is well documented. There's a huge scholarship, and it tends to be common women who really, in order to get better pay, they go into male occupations and often into the military. That was true in the American Revolution. You know, not hundreds of women, but you know, a score of women, and some of them actually, Deborah Sampson is the best known of the revolutionary group, but there are some others, you know, came out and made money after the war by telling the tale and going on the lecture circuit. It happened in Europe, it happened in South America, it happened in Asia, seems to be a pretty broad-based phenomenon.
Hmm. Does a listener want to follow up?
Oh, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Also, there are all kinds of stories about this kind of behavior on the part of women in fiction.
Yes.
Immediately comes to mind the film that Barbara Streisand made, Yentl.
Yes, yes. It's a cultural motif even in folk tales, and certainly we remember the Disney film Mulan. I remember my grandchildren going to that film and loving it. So in a sense, what if a woman behaved like a man? It's one of those cultural motifs, and what's fascinating about it is it happens. People, the scholars who've done detailed studies of the various figures, see economic motivation, a desire for adventure, but they also see a kind of pushing the boundaries of gender and resisting the narrow roles that were assigned to people in some societies. There's this wonderful story from Vietnam legends about a 19-year-old girl named Lady Tru, who led a revolt, kind of Joan of Arc kind of figure, led a revolt against Chinese rule. And one source said that when people asked her why she didn't marry, she answered, "I wish to ride a strong wind and tame fierce waves, kill sharks in the Eastern Sea, force back the Chinese armies, and throw off the chains of slavery. How could I possibly become some man's servant?" So she was a very feisty woman.
Yeah. So we have, throughout history, we have these feisty women. We have warriors and saints. When did women superheroes come to the pages of comic books and popular culture?
Well, the most famous one, of course, is Wonder Woman, which was in the 1940s, I believe, based loosely on the legend of the Amazon. And it kind of a kooky story about that. There's been some interesting new scholarship on the man who invented the character of Wonder Woman, who went through a lot of stages, depending on how, I mean, from a super patriot during World War II, and then different kinds of, you know, she got tamed a bit. And then she was revived, strangely enough. She was revived, or maybe not so strangely, but anyway, I hadn't realized this. I hadn't remembered this. In 1972, she was on the cover of the first issue of Ms. Magazine. The editor, Gloria Steinem, remembered what a sort of inspiring character this Wonder Woman had been in her youth, and she thought Wonder Woman had gotten kind of tamed and boring, and so she brought her back, and then she became a sort of feminist pop icon.
Yeah, charging ahead.
Charging ahead, solving the world's problems.
Yeah, no stopping her.
Yeah.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Really fun talking with you. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History. It is a Borzoi book published by Knopf.